Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives. As we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered, these tools are available through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years. To improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. It's absolutely free. Click the link, download it, copy it off as often as you'd like, and use it completely free of charge. There are also a whole host of audio files or shows like this one that can serve as a tutorial for how to use that tool. It's either people who've called in and been stepped through the use of that tool, or they've talked about the dynamics involved in the tool being as effective as it is, or they've given powerful testimonials about how the use of the tools improved their lives. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and you can get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We encourage people to do all of these things and explore the use of these tools. I say tools in plural because the Reality Management Worksheet is just one of a host of tools that Michael and Jeannie offer on that website. There are more than 14 or 15 different videos that you can purchase from Michael, 2-hour lectures that most of the videos have an accompanying tool, like the Mind Goal Management Sheet, or the Three Early Memories of Conflict, or the Responsibility Communication Tool, etc. And we encourage people to download these tools, start using them, call in with questions or comments. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. I had an email that asked a couple questions. We've been going through the Way of Mastery, and yesterday we were going back into lesson four for the second time. And Susan writes, the Way of Mastery suggests that we work on the seven pages of desires in community. And really what it's saying is that after you've done this work on your own, if you want to take it to the next level, you get a friend and you undress in front of the friend. What does that mean? You share what you came up with in your desires. So the exercise is that you get up, clear your head, breathe comfortably, and have a sheet of paper there so you can write on it. And ask yourself what you would really like in this moment, what you would desire in this moment. And then, as openly as possible, as accurately as possible, just write down whatever comes to your mind. Then clear your head, get into your breath again, and then ask again, what do I want in this moment? And then clear your head and do it again, what do I want in this moment? And you do that six or seven times, and then you put that paper away. You don't review it. You put it away. And then the next time you're called to do the exercise, you do the same thing. New sheet of paper, here's what I'd like to do, write it down, take a breath, clear your head, ask again, what do I want now? And you do that about seven times. After you've done that process, so you've got seven or eight, nine sheets of paper, now you begin to go back and review what you have listed as your desires so that you can start to look at the pattern of desires. That's not the end of the exercise. What they're recommending is that on a regular basis, you give yourself time to clear your mind and ask what wants to express through me in this moment and write it down. So this is the building of a muscle. This is the building of a spiritual faculty of being able to stay aligned and attuned to the voice for the Creator, etc. And if you do that and you strengthen that, then eventually when you're ready to take that to the next level, you get some friends. And you say, hey, let's share what comes up when we do this exercise. And that's really staying wide open. That's being completely open and honest and when considered in the context of most of the Western cultures, that will resonate fear because we have been trained and conditioned to think we need our privacy and we shouldn't tell other people our intimate thoughts, etc. So the next question in this email is, are these desires the same as goals? And the answer to that is definitely no. Not. So a desire isn't a thing. In this lesson, the word desire refers to this energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment. It's like that life nectar that comes up through the roots of the plant and moves up the stem and gives life and the ability for the flower to bloom and produce colors and aroma. It's the elixir of life. It's not a single thing, and it's not a thought. Thoughts and intentions and plans can arise as we learn to tap into that energy and that flow. And then a goal, in the way Michael Rice talks about it in this work, is one of those plans or intentions, one of those ideas I've had that I have decided to elevate to the level of action. I've somehow mentally committed to taking an action to create something, to make something happen. That's Michael's definition for a goal. I've taken something out of the realm of thought or plan or intention or interest or passion, I've taken it out of that realm and moved it to the level of behavior. I'm committed to do a behavior to make this happen. And then there's some questions about, you know, having a certain desire to be done with certain chores or activities and wondering what that's about. Well, the idea in this lesson is to develop a practice where I can tune into, I can become aware of my own ability to have an open, awakened heart, to move more of my conscious awareness to this open, awakened state, away from the thinking state. It's right there in the first lesson where it says, you know, right in page 5, right after it talks about the first axiom. And the first axiom in this work simply reads, you don't experience anything, right? Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice. And then, you know, 3/4 of the way down that page, the little simple paragraph reads, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. For indeed, that aspect of your mind, the intellect, was never designed to be your master. It was designed to be the humble and, if you will pardon the expression, the very stupid servant of the awakened heart. So this is, you know, the first 12 lessons. This whole first book, which was intended to be a book unto itself, is called The Way of the Heart. So what they're doing in the first 2 lessons is calling our attention to the fact that we are creating our own experience, regardless of whether or not we are consciously aware of it. So that the first 2 lessons could be said to be bringing our attention to a process that's always been with us, that we've been either completely unaware of or conditioned out of believing is true. We've been conditioned to believe, you are making me angry, you're hurting my feelings, that situation's upsetting, etc. So critical to this work is making more and more of a shift away from the intellect into the open heart. Understanding what Einstein was talking about when he said, we've been given a precious gift and a faithful servant. The precious gift is the intuitive mind, the creative intuitive mind. And the faithful servant is the conscious, logical, rational mind. The difficulty, Einstein says, is that we live in a culture that has literally forgotten the precious gift. We are not taught about our intuition and how to strengthen it and develop it, and tools and techniques for realigning with it. And worse than that, and that's bad enough, but to make matters even worse, we live in a culture that has elevated the faithful servant to the level of master. This is pushing science way ahead, out in front of everything else, as though there isn't anything else. So it's forgotten our most precious gift, which is our awakened heart, which our intuitive mind, which our connection to the creative flow, and furthermore has conditioned us to believe that the intellect has all the answers and should be our master. So you could look at the first 2 lessons as trying to wake us up to the fact that we are in error. That we are in error in relying too much on the intellect and not moving our awareness into our open heart, to awaken our heart. And, you know, this book has headings like, peace flows from alignment with the mind of God. Peace is not going to come for me figuring out how to get peaceful. Right? It's just not going to happen. Another heading in this book is mastery arises from innocence, not from the diligent application of my intellect over and over and over again. So then we get into lesson three, and lesson three says, okay, we've been trying to wake you up to the fact that you're creating your experience of life. Let us help you understand how, without understanding, without knowing that, without being trained in that, there's an automatic dynamic that happens every time you think someone outside of you has caused your upset, and that's called projection. And instantaneously, faster than you can follow it with thought, your mind creates an image that tries to help you believe, make you believe that people outside of you have caused your upset, blinding you to the actual process of how you create your own experience, which is laid out in the first two lessons. So the process of forgiveness is waking up to realize that every time I have a negative thought about someone outside of me, it means I have denied the process that's laid out in the first two axioms, that I'm the one creating my own experience, and my mind is therefore projecting instantaneously images in my mind containing my pain and the dynamic I'm using to cause it into my mind's image of somebody else, and I instantly think they are the one with the problem. So forgiveness means to release another from the perceptions I have been projecting upon my images of them. It's therefore an act of dissolving the negative projections in my own mind. And the more I do that, the more I get rid of the false perceptions and negative projections, the more I see the depth and the clarity of my own consciousness with purity and clarity, I get to see the shimmering radiance that's giving rise to me and the shimmering radiance of energy, the energy of creation, that is giving rise to everyone and everything I see. So then I get access to the greatest gift that I could ever receive, because I come to see the world around me and all my brothers and sisters exactly the way their Creator sees them, which is with love, compassion, equanimity, see the truth of the radiance of the creative love expressing through them. And anything less than that is an error in my perception and something I can dismantle to receive the greatest gift I would ever receive. So that's what all lesson three is about. Now lesson four is going to take things to another level and say, we have this training, this conditioning that says you shouldn't want to be rich and you shouldn't want to be great and you shouldn't want to acknowledge your power. And so we have words, energies, emotions wrapped around the concept of desire that are specifically designed to get us to move away from desire, to shut it off, to label it as bad, etc. And this chapter says nothing could be further from the truth. Desire is the energy of life, of creation. It's a frequency, it's a vibration, it's an expansion of the creative force, and it's there to guide you, to help you create consciously with clarity. And so if we're going to do that, we need to identify and then put down, dismantle, all of our negative judgments against desire. And learn with practice how to tune into that energy and make the choice consciously throughout the day more and more often to take a breath and tune into that energy. The phrase you can use for that is, what do I want right now? You could use a phrase like, what is mine to do here to be a blessing to myself and others? But this is a practice that as I engage it, as I cultivate it as a practice, it strengthens in me. So that brings us to page 47 in lesson 4. The title of the heading at the top of the page is Releasing Judgment of Desire. And the text calls us to learn then, learn through simple practice to interrupt the patterns you have learned from this illusory world, your culture, your family, you know, the television, the philosophies. Learn to interrupt the patterns you've learned from this illusory world so that you release judgment of the energy of desire. I can't release the judgment of the energy of desire until I recognize it. I need to be observing. This is the Krishnamurti work, always observing, wide awake, questioning for yourself in each new present moment. This is Rainier Maria Rilke's work. We must learn to live in the question without demanding answers, without moving into the intellect that's going to find all the answers and crunch down all the numbers. We must learn to recognize our judgment of desire and then release it. And it says, this will be different for each and every one depending upon where you begin. So here's a really simple exercise. When you awaken in the morning and you've planted your feet firmly on the floor, take pause and ask yourself this question. What do I want right now? Right away, your mind will say, well, I'm too busy to know what I want. I've got to go off to work. I have to serve everybody else. I'm here to satisfy the world. I've got no time to ask myself what I want. Please remember that what you decree is, you are a creator. That's the whole first two lessons in this book. You're creating your experience. And the thought that you hold in the mind will be reflected through the nature of your experience. So when you hold the thought, I'm just too busy, I've got too much to do, you will create the experience that you're too busy. You don't have the time to even ask yourself, what do I want right now? And then take a breath or two and just notice. So please, pause and ask, what do I want? When you pause and ask, you create the experience of having enough time to pause and ask. When you ask, what do I want? And you've taken the pause to do that, then simply give yourself 1 minute to observe whatever comes up in the mind, or even what is felt in the body. Just observe. The text reads, heaven forbid, you might want to have sex. Oh, well, then you would know that for sure that you're not a spiritual being. You might want to take a hot shower. You might want a glass of juice or water. You might want to sing. You might want to stretch or breathe. You might want to turn and look at your lover, your mate, who's still sleeping on the bed. You might want to arise and sneak into your children's room and watch them sleep. You might want to sit down and read the morning paper. Just notice what you want. This is not, do this, ask yourself what you want, and go do it. This is about the practice of tuning into what is that energy that's always there. Remember the phrase we're using in this work that the word desire stands for is the energy of creation, which, by the way, is always flowing, and the energy of creation as it wants to express uniquely through you in this moment. So please understand, this is not a how to get more work done in your life. This is not an exercise about how to get more efficiently through your to-do list. This is an exercise of slowing down, pausing, turning inside and asking yourself, what do I want right now? It's an exercise of tuning into the energy of desire through your awakened heart, putting the intellect aside, as we do in every worksheet process, put my conscious logical mind on the shelf for now and ask to be shown something else. The text goes on. The point here is to notice that by asking the question, something will respond within you. And when that response comes, notice, observe, slow down, pause, breathe, be aware, be awake. Notice that there is a feeling associated with it. There is a quality that makes the cells of your body sing just a little bit. Now that is going to be a subtle energy shift. Some of us will recognize it as very powerful somewhere down the line. But in the beginning, that's going to be so slight, so gentle, it's going to be imperceptible to the usual senses. Back to that brief paragraph. The point here is to notice, slow down, observe, cultivate, practice, become aware at deeper and deeper levels. The point here is to notice that by asking the question, you've set something in motion. You've turned your awareness to a flow of energy that's always been there, and something will respond within you. It will become more and more obvious to you the more you practice this and you strengthen your ability to align with that energy. And when that response comes, notice, observe, breathe, tune into the fact that there is a feeling associated with it. It's a quality that makes your cells sing just a little bit. That energy, that quality is the elixir of life called desire. So this exercise on page 47 is not about this is how you get more done. This isn't the law of attraction. This isn't, you know, think and grow rich. This is a simple exercise to help you use your awakened heart to awaken even more and tune that awakened heart into the vibrational frequency of the energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment. The text goes on. In this 1 minute, you need not rise to act, but simply observe. What do I want? Oh, to take a hot shower. The feeling of the thought, or the thought that emanates the feeling in the body, I want to take a hot shower. That process is carried on the elixir of desire. And this exercise is about awakening my ability to be aware of that energy, of that elixir, of that creative energy wanting to express uniquely through me in the moment. The text reads, desire is coming from a depth of your own being that, again, we've mentioned this before, it rests right next to the face of the Creator. It might just be that by following the desire that wells up through your heart, by feeling it, by embracing it, you might learn and discover what the ocean is wishing to express through the wave that you are. If you judge desire, and we've all been trained to judge desire, might you not be shutting off the creative flow that the mind of the Creator wishes to express? Of course, that is the problem. You have been given the infinite capacity to choose the focus of your conscious awareness, So if you choose to judge desire as bad, you will shut off your awareness of it. You will move away from it. You will not listen to it. You will not learn to discern its powerful, subtle energies. And you will redirect the flow that might want to express uniquely through you in the moment in a creative, compassionate, loving way into something more constricted, more fear-based, more vengeful, etc. The text reads, of course, that is the problem. You have tied the hose into a knot through conflicted judgments of this energy of desire. Here's a very common one in your world. Be honest with yourself. How many times have you felt the desire to be wealthy? Is it not something you're supposed to sit around and talk about? It is not something that you're supposed to sit around and talk with people about and make public, especially if you're trying to be spiritual. You may have thought, I woke up this morning and just imagined how having so many golden coins that I could buy the entire planet. And then you remembered, money is the root of all evil. I can't think that way. Well, I better get busy and get off to my office job. Now, while there, secretly inside, I really resent the job because they don't pay me what my soul is worth. But I know the game. I'll pretend that I'm quite fine. Money? No, I don't need money. Thanks, I'm fine. Really, I have enough. And then as you drive home, a Mercedes pulls up alongside you, and you can't help but turn and say, oh, my God, I wish I could afford one of those. Instantly, you think, oh, my God, I can't have that thought. So I'll just drive my old beat-up Volkswagen down the road. But I'm being a very good spiritual person. If you're honest with yourself, think about how many times you have felt welling up within you the desire to be wealthy. What on earth has caused you to fear that desire? What has caused you to tie the hose in a knot so that you try to block that desire from coming into manifestation? Perhaps when you were a child, you went to one of your cathedrals, and there was someone in a long robe standing on a platform, and because everything looked so beautiful, you thought, well, surely they must be speaking with authority. And since this cathedral was filled with a whole lot of small little minds that were all living their own level of fear, they said, money is the root of all evil. And you thought, oh, well, that's the truth. Oh, yes, that's the truth. Oh, God, I better fear money. This next paragraph is at the heart of what we try to say over and over here in Mind Shifters Radio. The whole of this work, the whole of the Christ Mind teachings, is to help you develop your connection to your inner source, to relieve you of the habit and pattern of looking outside of yourself for a guru or a priest or a teacher. I say unto you, you have one authority. And it is never held within the office of any church or any organization or any one individual. Your authority is the voice for the Creator that dwells within your heart and within your mind. The Creator is not limited and does not require her children to be limited. For if you would receive all that the Creator would give you, you must decide to rise up and be the grandest wave that you could possibly be. For only in so doing do you honor your Creator. The text goes on and says, you could say that God is like a wise gardener who is constantly trying to grow beautiful roses. She knows exactly how much moisture to put in the soil. She knows how to make those nutrients rise from the soil through the roots, up through the heart of the stem, up through the flower, to give forth radiant color so that everyone that looks upon it is touched by the mystery of beauty. And she wonders, well, this is interesting. These roses I've created seem to have a mind of their own. As the elixir I give them rises through the stems, they tie themselves in little knots, and only a little bit of the elixir reaches out. So the petals never quite blossom fully. Have you ever had the feeling that you were putting more energy into staying constricted than you are into allowing expansion? The next section is titled, Desire Links You to the Will of the Creator. Desire is creation. You know, earlier we had the definition of desire 3 or 4 pages back. Desire is that energy which brings forth all waves of creation out of the depths of the ocean of life itself. So here we're reminded, desire is creation. Therefore, what you desire is of supreme importance because you're going to create according to your desires and according to whether or not you judge desire, run from it, feel constricted, feel tense, feel negative about it, or you learn to allow its flow and read its energy and integrate it into your life. Desire is creation. Therefore, what you desire is of supreme importance. If you will take the little exercise that we have given you and begin to put it into practice upon awakening in the morning in a very simple and quiet way, you will begin to get back in touch with the innocence and beauty of the movement of desire. You can delight in it. When you have a sexual thought, a sexual desire, why not just be with it? Why not notice what it causes to happen in the body? How does your breath change? Does your heart beat faster? Be honest with yourself. Is it not putting a smile on your face? What if you decided to honestly embrace that effect as being perfectly innocent and beautiful? How might your day change if you did not repress awareness of sexual desire? You will notice we are not saying you should walk down the street and grab everybody that walks by you. We're talking about allowing yourself the living embrace of exactly what energy is moving through your being. Why is this important? If you have decided that there are certain energies that are demonic, evil, or have the power to distract you from your union with your Creator, you have already decided there is something beyond the reach of your power. And that is what disempowers you. Your choice to think there is something beyond the reach of your power. You take an innocent energy and turn it into a monster that must be feared at all costs. So remember, the first two lessons were all about helping us understand each of us creates our experience of life. So if we buy into the teachings of a church or a culture or a family that says strawberries are bad, hugs are bad, sexual thoughts are bad, money is bad, then we will create the experience of fear around any of those energies or thoughts. And for us, that will be our reality. We will be creating that reality. We'll take an innocent energy and turn it into a monster that we must fear at all costs. The text goes on to say, the last paragraph on page 49, yet I say this unto you, the mystical transformation that carries you from feeling yourself to be a disempowered little drop of foam on the edge of a wave, all the way to the sense of freedom and empowerment that flows from the mind of the Creator that wants to express only through you, only beautiful creations filled with majesty, power, and miracles, the energy, the mystical transformation that makes that happen is willingness. The willingness to turn the very energies that move through the mind and the body, turn to them and not fear them. Allow, accept, embrace, and thereby transcend all things. But instead of turning away from them, look upon them with innocence and wonder. So that paragraph again says, yet I say this unto you, the mystical transformation that carries you from feeling yourself to be a disempowered little drop of foam on the edge of a wave, carries you from there to the sense of freedom and empowerment and empowered living that flows from the mind of the Creator through you to express only beautiful creations that are filled with majesty, power, and miracles. That mystical transformation happens through willingness. Willingness to turn to the very energies that move through the mind and the body and embrace them rather than fear them. Look upon them with innocence and wonder. This is the source of the myths that have been told in all cultures. The knight that slays the dragon, or kissing the wild beast on the cheek and it becomes a loving companion. Your monsters, the ones you've created, the ones your family and friends and culture have created for you, your monsters are what you fear and repress because of the judgments you have learned in the world. And the world is only the denial of the kingdom, capital K, kingdom. So, to translate this into Michael Rice's understandings from A Course in Miracles and the Kabor's manuscript, the world that we create is our reality through our perceptions. And it is a denial of actuality, of the truth of the kingdom that the Creator has created, of the expansion of creative energy in form. To think, quote, perhaps I would do well to embrace it, love it, master it, and allow it, dropping the fear that I've generated. Text goes on. Imagine someone says unto you, money is the root of all evil, and then puts out her hand and says, would you please make a donation to our organization? Is that not an expression of conflict? Yet that kind of conflict permeates the religions and the dogmas of your world, which tell you don't desire money, don't desire wealth. But by the way, to keep this ministry on the radio station, we really need you to send in a donation. Ask yourself, what are they trying to teach you And what are they in denial of? Sex and money. These are pretty basic things, aren't they? They represent energies that flow from the mind of the Creator, which would express in unlimited joy and power and not be willing to settle for any limitation of any kind. When the earth was birthed from the Creator's holy mind and took on its own form and became an entity just like you, the Creator did not say, well, this is a pretty beautiful planet, but I can only have a solar system just large enough for the earth. Rather, out of joy, the Creator allowed there to come forth solar system upon solar system upon solar system, the birthing of 1,000 suns every moment. As a field in which this beautiful jewel of a planet could spin, that is true creation. What quality of solar system have you decided to allow in which the planet of your awareness can spin and live and express? Desire is everything. The simple exercise we have given you will begin to free up the blocks within you, and you will rediscover the innocence of desire. Then you can begin to expand upon it, to take a few moments to learn to live deliberately, asking yourself, what do I truly want? Use your consciousness to relax into the innocence of the question and sink out of the intellect into the open heart, into your feeling space. What do I truly want? What is it in my heart that keeps calling to me, that keeps compelling me? The text goes on, because your mind shines forth like a sunbeam to the sun from the mind of the Creator, when you ask the question, pictures will begin to arise. Feelings will begin to arise. And I say unto you, they are symbols and expressions of what the Creator wants to bring forth through you. You may say, every time I look in my heart and every time I allow myself to feel it, what I really want is to put my arms around people. I want to let people know how much I love them. Why would you fear such a desire? Do you say, well, it's too overwhelming. I don't know how I will be accepted. The text asks, who cares how you will be accepted? What matters is how you accept yourself. What if by feeling that desire, new pictures begin to come to you? For example, suddenly you realized, what I want to do is join the Peace Corps. Perhaps that very decision would be like putting yourself in a solar system where you can spin as your own planet. What if going and being in the Peace Corps could be the very pathway through which you learn to receive the great joy of letting your love out into the world? But if you fear desire, how can you ever know these things? What comes up for you by asking that question? It might be, I want to have so much wealth. And I see that the thought says, oh no, wealth is bad. But if you would allow yourself to continue to ask the question, a deeper answer will emerge, such as, what I want is to be able to go to all the hungry children on the planet and feed them. That's why I want to be wealthy. Could it not be that the desire to feed the world is the Creator's desire to speak through you, to use you in a way that affects transformation upon your planet? Can you see that by blocking the feeling of desire, you might just be blocking yourself from hearing what you keep praying for over and over? You pray and you say, Father, reveal thy purpose to me. And then you feel the desire and say, oops, excuse me, Father, I've got to get rid of this desire first. Desire in the heart is where you will discover the phone line that links you to the will of the Creator that would express through you. If you do not trust desire, you are literally saying that you have decided not to trust your Creator. That is a statement not just to be brushed aside. In healing the conflict around desire, now that you know what it truly is, learn to be patient with yourself. So since that's a statement not to be brushed aside, we'll repeat that paragraph on page 51, just past the halfway point. Desire in the heart is where you will discover the phone line that links you to the will of the Creator that would be expressed through you. If you do not trust desire, you are literally saying that you've decided not to trust your Creator. That is a statement not to be just brushed aside. In healing the conflict around desire, now that you know what it truly is, please learn to be patient with yourself. Bottom of page 51, the next heading reads, An Exercise in Trusting Desire. We would suggest that you create a structure by which a second exercise can be practiced that fits into your life. Again, it need not take more than 5, 10, or 15 minutes initially, perhaps 3 or 4 times a week. Eventually, you'll be doing this all the time because you will be creating deliberately. To begin with, for just 10 or 15 minutes, set aside your world. Remember, you need do nothing, so the world can wait. Relax the body and close the eyes. It can be of great benefit to let the breath become very deep and rhythmic. It relaxes the nervous system, and it seduces the controller within your mind, that critic within your mind that decides what thoughts are acceptable and which ones are not. By the way, the critic is never something you created. It is something that you let live in your mind that was made up by a lot of other fearful minds called parents and teachers. So as you relax the body and the mind, ask yourself, what do I truly want? Observe the images that come. Accept them openly, allowingly. Notice any judgment and release it. Notice the feelings in the body and allow this to go on for just a minute or two. Then pause, open your eyes, and write down all that you can remember. For example, I saw the image of having 47 sexual partners. I saw the image of having golden coins rain down upon me so that I had to have an umbrella over my head. I saw huge bowls of ice cream. I saw myself in a boat on the ocean. I noticed that my stomach got tight. Whatever it is, write it down. Take a deep breath, relax, and again, repeat the process. You may want to place your hand so it rests on your heart. Breathe into it a few times and then ask, what do I truly desire? Again, allow the process to be what it is. Do this over a period of 10 or 15 minutes so that you repeat the process at least 6 or 7 times, writing everything down. Then take the piece of paper or the journal and put it aside until the next exercise period, and then repeat the process again. After you've done that whole process 7 times so that you have 7 sheets of paper in which you've gone through this process over and over and over again, then and only then do you begin to look back through all the things that came up. And you ask yourself, what seems to be repeating? You might notice that 3 times you wanted a huge bowl of ice cream, but then it seemed to fade away. Then you had a desire for 47 lovers, but now you notice you really only want one. Whatever it might be, notice the pattern. The thread that seems to run the most throughout the exercise periods. Then imagine that thread to be an energetic link that is tied at one end to a piece of foam at the edge of a wave, and the other is anchored to the depth of the ocean. And then consider that perhaps if you allowed yourself to move down that thread, to put your energy on that, to begin to clear up the obstacles within your consciousness that block that desire from being consistently lived from, that you would carry yourself from the drop of foam at the edge of the wave to the heart of creation itself. Here comes the warning. Remember, along the way, everything unlike love will come up for you to release it. During that process, you could go through a metamorphosis that would culminate in your being the living incarnation of the power of Christ. Your soul would realize the fulfillment it has always sought. For you see, the book says, the reason you've cleverly decided to trick yourself into blocking the energy of desire is that the soul knows that were it to follow such a thread through the whole and total commitment, it will be embarking on the pathway set before you by the Creator that knows how to take you home. And if you arrive at home, it means you will have to give up being a seeker. You will have had to come and become one who has found. And you will have to rise above the crowd. You will have to give up all of your identity with smallness. You will have to give up needing the approval of others. And you will have left the nest of insanity. You will have arisen and taken up your rightful place at the right hand of the Creator. Is that not the deepest fear you carry, to actually be the truth of who you are, Christ incarnate? So, that's where we'll leave it for today. The challenge is laid out. The gauntlet's been thrown. Will you engage in the practice of tuning your awareness into the energy of desire? Will you gently, gradually, playfully shift more and more of your conscious awareness away from the intellectual mind into the feeling space of the awakened heart? So, that's the end of our show for the first hour. The second hour will start with Jeannie and whoever. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll welcome Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Sam. Appreciate you. I really enjoy the reading.
You're welcome and deserving. Have a wonderful show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, March the 1st, 2022. Welcome to March. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. Michael is down in Sarasota, Florida, and he texted me a moment ago that he was going over to John's office, and if he could join us, that he would. So I'm not sure if he's going to get on or not. So if somebody has a question, press 1. And if you don't, I'm going to do a reading out of my book. So give just a moment. Nobody's pressing 1. Michael's not on yet. So one of the chapters in my book is called Be Aware. And it's part of, you know, my book is broken into 3 sections. And one section is about my journey and some of my issues and things that have happened. Then the middle section is actually 3 chapters that are taken from some psychology papers that I wrote when I went back to college. And they're very relative to the book. And so I've included those. And then the last 3 are about the healing process. So this one chapter, and this is just from the rough draft of it, but it's called Be Aware. And becoming aware is a big one. And I realized that there are several points that I need to strengthen and heal. The first one is to become aware of what is real. This sexual abuse that I experienced impacted many areas of my life outside of the bedroom. A good example of this, 44 years past the last event of abuse, and I was facilitating a breath session. There were several people in the room. People were paired up. And the lady that I was coaching started thrashing and screaming, and she was actually pulling out her hair. And I was attempting to hold her and speak calmly to her and to bring her back to actuality. And in this wild state, she was so much stronger than me. And I was concerned that she was going to hurt herself and hurt me. She was so activated by the reality in her mind that she was beyond reasoning, and her behavior was pure madness. While outwardly I looked like I was in control, inside I was losing it. Interesting that my inside turmoil matched her outside behavior, silently screaming, thrashing, and going insane and hurting myself, pure madness. As soon as my partner, Michael, came over and took control of the situation, I fled and went upstairs to my room. I knew enough to know that in the state that I was in, that I would be no good to the other participants. I was physically shaking by now and in tears. I called a friend who happens to also be a psychologist, and I told him about the lady and the situation downstairs. He knew by my voice that I was lost in my own panic. He stopped me, knowing the situation upstairs was the only one that I could change. He said, "Jeannie, stop. Take 3 deep breaths." And he paused while I did that. "Now look around the room that you are in and name 3 things that you can see." And he paused. When I named those, then he said, "Now name 3 things that you can hear." And he waited. "Now name 3 things you can feel." And he paused for me to answer. "Name 3 things that you can smell." "Now breathe deeply." We did that all over again. When he finally was convinced that I was actually present, then he began to walk me through my thoughts that were behind my feeling of panic and fear. What came out of this process had nothing to do with the lady downstairs. But I recalled when my first husband had become so absorbed in his reality, and he would be crazy, and things would go out of my control, and I got physically hurt. I was not strong enough to defend, and talking did nothing to make a change in the resulting pain. My need to survive was strong, and the thought that I wouldn't make it was equally strong. I remained in that abusive situation for 3 years, and when I finally got out, I pushed all of those emotions and thoughts down deep, hoping to never go there again. I went about my life controlling as much as I could in my environment to stay safe. When things got beyond my control, fear or panic set in, often masked behind anger. I realized that that is how he won over me, by exhibiting fierce anger. I despise the anger that comes up when I feel that I'm cornered and I need to come out fighting. When I feel the fear, my first instinct is to look for a reason to leave, whether it's to leave the bedroom, to leave the house, to leave my body. This is my default in order to protect myself. This lady downstairs was my perfect trigger. She outwardly portrayed what was inside me all those years. I know I must remove that pure madness in order to stop recreating it in my world. I must embrace it to heal it. I must give myself permission to feel what is real. Can I do that? Do I dare take new risks with intimacy? This doesn't mean just with a partner. There is intimacy in every relationship or friendship. Into me, see. Do I let another person get close enough to see the real me? Can I ever trust another person with my being? The demands placed on me in that first marriage I perceived as a threat to my very survival, and so I became very independent and put up a false bravado to appear less desperate and vulnerable. That experience in the past, not the present moment, I must be willing to open to the possibility. I wanted that desperately then, but I was afraid. I felt I was trying to run a marathon, and yet I couldn't put one foot in front of the other to even get out of the starting gate. I needed to learn to take baby steps and realize that when a baby falls, it's part of its success in learning to walk. If it quit when it fell once, twice, 20 times, then it would never learn. A huge lesson for me was to slow down the inner chatter that was, is advising me of what was real, to not get lost in the past and confuse it with the present based on expectation and perception. Stay present, open my eyes, and breathe deeply. Excuse me, I just unplugged my phone. So that's one part of 7 part of that chapter. So I'll stop there and see if anybody has a comment or a question. And do you understand what I was saying about the present situation was really behind a filter of my past? And yes, there was something actually going on, and she was out of control. But what I was feeling, what I was experiencing, was my inner turmoil. Does that make sense? Does anybody have any questions or comments? Not. I'll go to the second section. So it is to become aware of the urge to withdraw or to leave. There is an immediate autobiological response to a perceived threat. The brain sends a signal and the pituitary and adrenals release stress hormones, adrenaline, cortisol, norepinephrine. It's a fight or a flight hormone. Then there is the freeze response. When one believes that there is no use to fight or flee, then the body releases painkillers called endorphins and opiates and the ability to appear dead, to disconnect. It's like what a possum does. One usually comes out of this state shaking, and often with little memory of the event. When PTSD occurs, especially at night, when the veil is up more open to the unconscious and those memories flood forward, the freeze is what happened when I was being abused. I disassociated from my own body to not be present, to not experience the pain full force. So it was useful for surviving the onslaught and to distance myself from the memory. But the body remembers, and that cannot be changed by thinking it through or figuring it out. And he, my abuser, did not care if I was present or not. I was just a means to his release. He told me once when I locked myself in a bedroom that if I did not let him come in, that was fine. He would just go get a whore, and it was just all the same to him. That was within the first year of our marriage, and I stayed because my thought was that no one else would have me, especially now that I was used goods, quote unquote. So I depended on this survival skill and became hyper alert. Normally after a trauma, there is the action of the parasympathetic nervous system that basically slows down the heart rate and sends a signal that the crisis has passed. Well, my abuse happened almost daily for 3 years, and the continual deluge of hormones and no calm time in between created a body burnout. The links were so strongly formed that when one file triggered, I immediately disassociated, and I'm not real sure that I ever re-entered a form. What happens now when I withdraw? In my mind, it's still safety, but the reaction to others is different. Most will ask, what's wrong, or where did you go, or a penny for your thoughts. If they begin to push me, then I flip into the anger mode that I spoke about before. Yet now I think I am self-sabotaging as much as protecting myself. If I continue this behavior of leaving, am I going to eventually pass some limit on their part? Will they ultimately get tired of trying to help me in my process and do the same thing, withdraw or leave? It's easy for someone to say, I'm not him, take me out of the file that's in your head. It's not so easy to stay and trust for a different outcome. I realize I do need to create reality checks, like the Be Present exercise, and reinforce the differences in the current person and my former instead of going on the internal chaos. I also know that there is the fact of nonverbal body memory, amplified by the deluge of hormones, and this can't be changed by thoughts alone. However, being aware of the cue and the urge to leave is a first step toward breaking that connection, towards forgiveness. So again, so that's the second section in that chapter. I will stop and wait and see if anybody has any comments. Does it ring a bell? Does it resonate? Has anybody been there, done that? Nobody's going to talk to me today, huh? Okay. I will go to the third section. So to become aware of the unreasonable drive to please others, I often lose sight of my authenticity. I give up who I am and what I want in order to be what I think that they want me to be and to do what they want me to do. Who are they? Everyone in my life. It began early with my family, and because I wanted a peaceful home, I took it on that I could keep everyone happy. Boy, did I overestimate my own power. No matter what I did, I could not please my parents, my grandmother, my brothers, at least not all the time. Then with my teachers from kindergarten to college, I would prove how valuable I was in their class by overachieving. Ultimately, I was proud of my own accomplishments, but they did not seem to change that much. My bosses, they realized I would do whatever was asked, and thus they asked a lot. I became overwhelmed, and the pattern became an expectation instead of an attaboy. Then my big wake-up call came. With my first husband, the drive to please him did not keep the abuse at bay, nor keep him happy. I eventually realized this was not a healthy way to maintain peace, nor to hold their relationship together. I would completely forget me in the equation. But then again, I would be safe. I need to remember me. I need to remember that I am love. I'm a being, not a thing. And I can live an inspired life. My giving to others and not receiving was and is out of balance. I have always felt if someone gave to me, then I needed to give back. And I am learning that while reciprocating is nice, it's not required. Receiving doesn't mean owing back. I am increasing my awareness of my own worth and to be open to receive. And again, I need to learn to have an accurate assessment of the present removed from the past and know it is okay to separate from unsafe situations or relationships. I need to continue doing my forgiveness work around being driven to please others and yet accept myself and be self-wise. So again, any questions? Aha, hand is up. Thank you, and I believe that this is Susan. So 610, well, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeannie. This is so powerful, what you've written. And I was writing you a text like saying, I was saying, don't expect us to say anything. None of us probably know what to say. But I definitely want you to know, at least I'm here and I'm sure many others are too. One question comes to mind. One comment first. I think all of us, maybe all humans, and maybe or maybe mostly women, but I'm not sure, feel that they have to please others and do what others want. It's almost like a cultural thing, and it's certainly not on the intense level that you're talking about, but it's there. But I had a question.
Yes.
You're talking about a situation when you were a grown woman, very young, yes, but was there anything in your early childhood which might have led you to accept this kind of treatment?
Actually, what mainly kept me there is that, well, one, I left home at 16. So all of this happened from 16 to 19. And
right.
That's when I was married, when I say I left home. And
yeah,
to admit what he was doing would basically be saying, you were right, I was wrong, I shouldn't have left home, I shouldn't have gotten married this young, and all of that. I never told anyone until... Actually, my mom attended a women's intensive in June of 2017, passed away in September of that year. And that was the first women's intensive that she had come to. And afterwards, I shared with her what had happened. And, I mean, the look on her face was shock. And it was also kind of like, if I ever see him, I'm going to kill him, that kind of a look. But no one in my family had ever gotten divorced. I mean, there was no cousins, aunts, uncles, anybody that I knew of. And it
right.
was sort of like, am I going to be the first one to, you know, get branded as, you know, being the one that didn't stay in a marriage or whatever? The main reason I finally got out of it is I was pregnant, and in the fourth month of my pregnancy, I miscarried. And I had no mm-hmm. clue where he was, because he would go out and be gone for weeks at a time and didn't want me to work, and he didn't want me to wear makeup, and he didn't want me to go out except to the grocery store. And he was dealing drugs, and, I mean, it was just craziness. And so I didn't know where he was, and I was in the process of losing this baby. And so I called my mom and dad, and they came and got me. I was like an hour away, and they came and got me, and they took me to the doctor, and then they brought me back to their house here. And then that afternoon I was in the hospital. And back then, you know, they would keep you for almost a week. And now it's like in and out. But anyway, when I got out of the hospital, I still had not heard from him. And so I came back to mom and dad's house to recuperate. And he called me about 4 or 5 days after I got out of the hospital and said his parents were going to be out of town and he was going to throw a party at their house, and did I want to come?
Oh my God.
And I said, well, for your information, I just lost their child. And no, I don't want to come. And I hung up. And mom told me that if I wanted to file for divorce, that she would help me get a lawyer. So she didn't know what all he had done to me prior to that, but she knew he wasn't present at a very crucial time in my life. So
So my question, I mean, I thank you for saying all that, and it completes a picture. It sounds as if your husband dictated how much contact you'd have with your family, or maybe you didn't want contact with your family anyway.
A little bit of both, yeah.
Okay, so, and you said you left at 16. Was there a bad situation at home that forced you, interiorly forced you to leave in the first place? Were you getting away from an abusive situation, for instance, at home?
There was no physical abuse. And now I understand some of the things Mom was going through, but she was just always angry. And, you know, it was almost like not necessarily angry at anybody in particular. She was just angry. And that's why Dad stayed gone a lot. And the clutter was crazy. I mean, I would straighten up one room so that if somebody, some friend wanted to come over, there would be one room that was a little bit clear where they could actually come sit down. And mm-hmm. it was just like a continual, you know, I kind of felt like Cinderella, you know,
yeah.
like doing the cleaning and all of that. And all of my clothes were homemade. I never had anything store-bought. And I guess just in my mind as a 16-year-old, you know, he was the first person that had paid any attention to me. And so in my mind, mm-hmm. it was like, I better grab on to him because nobody else wants me. And,
oh my God.
And so I didn't know that he was doing drugs. And, you know, he put up a really good facade. And like when we were dating, it was like, you know, lavished me with gifts. His mother actually bought me my first store-bought dress. You know, and she actually bought the ring to put on my finger so that others would know that I was in a class. You know, I mean, it's just they were very wealthy and well known in the city. And so that's a part of me too, because a lot of this is coming out. I don't name him by name, but mm-hmm. if anybody knows me, they will know who I'm talking about. And so there's a part of me that's like, oh, my gosh, is there going to be repercussions from me telling this story? But,
oh, my God.
I mean, it's all mm-hmm. true. And I have not seen them in, you know, I saw them once after we divorced. His grandmother passed away and actually went to the funeral. But. So, and he remarried within 3 months of us divorcing.
Mm.
So, you know, it's been a long time.
Wow. Well, you know, this isn't supposed to be a psychotherapy session or anything, but the more
no, that's
you
fine.
Tell, the more interested I feel to find out who Jeannie was, the Jeannie who left at 16.
Yeah.
It's also triggering for me because my daughter was in an abusive marriage for 25 years. It wasn't quite the same as yours. How could it be? All things like that are different, but it took her 25 years to get out of it for some of the same reasons you had. Plus, she was a priest, and she felt that having taken marriage vows, she wanted to honor them, and by then there were 3 children, and I mean, she got to that point instead of getting out earlier, and now she talks about it. She says, I was asleep, and so I'm thinking you were asleep. You were disassociating, as you said.
Right.
I think she did a lot of that, too. His abuse was mainly verbal and towards the little boys, too, as you know. But
right.
I'm curious about why it takes so long for any of us to stand up enough for ourselves and to allow ourselves to be conscious enough to take
right.
a stand. and you didn't take a stand. And then when you were doing your worksheet, you were talking about your dad leaving and how your dad used to leave. And here's your husband who was leaving. And
right.
Big issue.
Isn't it amazing then when you look at it that my immediate go-to is to leave? So it's like, you know,
right.
We do what we hate that they did.
Yep, exactly.
So I actually have another chapter that might answer that. This is actually one of the papers from my psychology class, and it's called
mm-hmm.
A Journey to My Realization. And we were studying about, I'm trying to flip down and find the reference. Erik Erikson, he named stages of psychological development. And so this paper kind of goes along with it. And so I'll read part of it, and it probably will answer that question of who was I? So in my present work, I refer to a newborn baby as pure being or pure love. I can see the world, culture, family, friends, putting expectations on the small child, and the child begins to think that they are not enough and that they have to do something more to receive approval. Approval and love become intermingled, and the true meaning of each one vanishes. We all have gone through this, moving from the stage that I call being to the stage of non-being, and often a person gets lost in their non-being state, and people never experience their true self again. I was lost for many years, but I was blessed with many people who were there to support me as I made my way back to being a more conscious, even though not completely finished or complete, person. My life has been very much in alignment with Erik Erikson's stages of psychological development. As he explains, he lists 9 distinct stages and states that each one is shaped by a conflict or a crisis that has to be resolved before the person can fully enter into the next stage in life. In reading my story, you will join me in retracing the steps of the journey to my realization by the use of his theory. We will reflect back through some of the major events of my life and see how each phase impacted the next one and how I ultimately moved through the conflicts to be where I am today. Mom was from Kentucky. Dad was from Virginia, but both attended Lincoln Memorial University in Harrogate, Tennessee, where they met for the first time. Mom and one of her college friends were on their way to church one evening when the rain started pouring down, and they ducked under the awning of a local movie theater. Standing under the awning was my dad and one of his college friends getting ready to go into the movie. Their friends knew each other and introduced them. They started dating, and within a year, they were married. They definitely had some challenges in the beginning. When my father graduated from college, he was almost immediately drafted and went off to war. My mother was getting ready to deliver my brother, their first child, and so she felt like she had to quit college. I arrived only 14 months later, and she never returned to complete her college. With Dad being away in service, my grandmother, my mother's mother, moved in to help out. Once Dad finished his time of service, we moved to the east coast of Virginia, and things began to settle into some semblance of normal. My two younger brothers came along 6 and 8 years after me, so we were almost like two different sets of kids. We did not have a lot of luxuries, but I think maybe the difficulties actually drew us closer. I don't remember a lot before the age of 5, but as far back as I can recall, we were a quote-unquote Christian home, and being loving was just how you acted towards one another. We never left home or went to bed without hugging and kissing everyone in the house, even if they were just there visiting. However, with all that love that was evident, I recall a time when I felt I was not loved the same as my older brother, and I began to mistrust the adults in my life. Without any explanation as to why, I did not trust my own feelings or my parents. This feeling of not being enough catapulted me into becoming a very independent child. I became what I call a human doer instead of a human being. I was always doing things to try to please everyone. Since I did not resolve the trust issue, I can see where that mistrust then followed me through the next stages of life. Although I was successful in being self-sufficient, I still felt a sense of doubt in my accomplishments. My life was emotional and automatic, not linear or logical. In hindsight, I see it was all just my own reality, and I realize now that my thoughts had no basis in what was actually going on in our family. We were all loved to the utmost by everyone else. There was no one left out, no one slighted. We lived and went to school in the city, but we had a farm in the country. We grew up knowing how to milk cows and bale hay and grade tobacco and feed chickens and gather eggs and slaughter our own cows and pigs. I think my family experienced the best of both worlds. My grandmother lived with us for over 20 years, and she and I shared a bedroom and a whole lot more. She was actually my go-to, my security. My three brothers had one room together. My parents had a room. Now, how seven of us managed with bathroom is amazing to me. Mm-hmm. Granny took me with her wherever she went to visit her other children or siblings. We were very close. I always felt I was closer to her than my own parents. I felt like I could confide in her. I could complain, and she never told on me. Every summer, we went to my other grandparents' house, my dad's parents, and worked on the farm. We worked the garden and helped with farm chores. They did not have running water, and I thought that was pretty cool to have to pump water from the well for drinking and washing. We had to take a bath in a galvanized tub sitting in the kitchen floor, and the toilet was an outhouse. We learned to be thankful for everything that we had. Whether we were in the city or in the country, there was always a lot of children around, and we would play all over the neighborhood way past dark. We always knew we were safe. We always would obey other kids' parents if we were playing in their yard, and everyone looked out for everyone else's children. Our community exemplified what is meant by the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child. Sadly, it isn't always the case today. Adults may feel it isn't their place to correct another person's child, and kids may think they don't have to listen to someone who isn't their own parent. I was extremely successful in school and dealt with the academic demands that were placed on me. Stayed on honor roll and was one of the best students in the class, and yet once again I had feelings of inferiority. Then something happened when I was 11 years old that I did not understand, nor did I know how to deal with the changes in my life. Early puberty, with no explanation as to what was going on, brought tremendous embarrassment and confusion about my self-worth. I desperately wanted a relationship, but one obstacle, at least in my opinion, was that my parents did not allow me to participate in a lot of activities, dances, movies, things that other teens enjoyed. I could not wear makeup or shorts, and my clothes were all handmade. Now I see more accurately and realize I was really well liked by my peers, but I felt like I was different in so many ways. This resulted in a decreased vision. I lost sight of my own purpose. I felt so weird and left out. The feeling of being lost in this world was a driver for me to find acceptance somewhere. I locked onto the first guy that showed me attention and got married at the age of 16 and left home. You've heard the saying, out of the frying pan and into the fire? Well, that was my life between this stage and the next. I'm only halfway through that paper, so I'll stop right there first and see. So that was, my reality as a child was so different than what was actuality. And the things of, me thinking that I was so weird and different and unacceptable and unloved and, it's like I felt like I was always in competition with my older brother. It didn't matter if I made honor roll. He would make who's who. It was like he was just always a step ahead. And so I think just searching for someone to accept me for me, and there again, my vision, I lost my vision and what I thought my first husband was not true. So I was just blinded. By what I wanted and not seeing what was really there.
Wow. So many questions. It's amazingly powerful what you're reading. The idea that a child who is so well loved and with so much variety and freedom offered and so much innate independence, or maybe it wasn't innate, but in any case, you grabbed it and ran with it. Where we get off track, how you got off track that far to not trust. It's a little scary to hear because it's almost as if it's impossible for a parent to be enough, aware enough to be able to help a child like you who has every reason to be just fine. I mean, I wonder if there's something else that happened that would cause you to draw away from your sense of yourself as okay.
Yeah, also, I've often wondered that too and thought about, you know, even I haven't seemed to be able to get it doing, you know, the breath or the worksheets or writing, or so I don't know if it's something that I have got so locked down. There were a couple things that came to me during one of the breath sessions, and I don't know if they're memories or, you know, if it really happened or I have no idea. But I know one is true. I was probably maybe 4 or 5, and I can remember Mom had, she didn't drive, and so when she would take us to the doctor or whatever for checkups, we had to ride the bus. And mm-hmm. when we got back home, then Dad was working on the car, and I remember I was so excited, and I said, the doctor said that I was going to grow up to be a very pretty young lady. You know, and I was just so excited that I had gotten that compliment. And Dad said, and I know he, well, I don't know, but he looked at me and he goes, yeah, pretty pigeon-toed.
I was and I am
pigeon-toed. And Dad will comment, Aria is pigeon-toed. Ryan was. And Dad will see her walking, and he'll go, oh, is she pigeon-toed? And I'm like, yes, and it's fine. You know, she's also left-handed. And every time he sees her drawing or something, it's like, oh, is she lefty? You know, I mean, it's like something's wrong with that. And when he does that, you know, I don't know that he really means anything by it, but it still triggers in me, there's nothing wrong with that. And it's even got a little bit of anger to it, you know.
I should think so. So after, oh, my goodness. What
so
a story.
I know. And then another memory, and like I said, I don't know that it was true, but that there was something with that doctor, too. And that maybe even as a little small child, you know, and his offering a compliment about, you know, you're going to grow up and be beautiful. And I wanted to hear that. Did he go beyond what a doctor is supposed to go beyond? I don't know. I've blocked that memory. But then I feel like there might be a link between receiving a compliment and allowing abuse. You know, just like I married at 16 because he was the first guy to pay attention to me. So then it would be, you know, he was my husband, so it's okay for him to abuse me. I never would have thought of calling it rape.
Right.
You know, without getting graphic, one time after quite a bit of abuse, I had to go to the doctor. And he said, I can't believe that you're still married to him.
Wow.
By the shape that my body was in. And, you know, a doctor today probably couldn't say something like that and get by with it. But so just
did that,
you know,
help you get connection. Away from your husband?
No, he didn't. He just, you know, planted the seed that, you know, you shouldn't be in this physical shape, you should be treated better. And, like, you know, I was basically swollen inside out. And when I got back home, I mean, even though I had just gone to the doctor to be checked out to see what could be done, he basically raped me when I got back home. And
Jeannie.
It's, you know, it's like, how do you, but, you know, then I think I've worked with people who are cutters. You know, they cut themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I have found just in working with the ones that I have worked with, it's like they do that because that is one pain that they can control to some degree.
Yeah.
Where their internal pain they can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point I lost control. I lost control of all of it, physical, mental.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, are you okay now? How did you find your way back?
it's still a process. One of the things that led us to recognize the disassociate, you know, Michael talks about dissociation, which is basically shutting something off and saying, you know, that's not mine, and so you can't see the truth in it. But disassociating is basically like you leave your body, like you hang out, you know, in the near the ceiling or something and watch. But it's a way of pulling away so that you don't feel the full impact of what's going on physically. And
Right. We
were in a restaurant, and Michael was one that he would ask me, you know, a penny for your thoughts. And I'd look at him and say, I didn't have any. And after it happened a couple times, then we started actually kind of delving into it, like, okay, something just happened. So instead of trying to figure out where my thoughts went, because I really was blank, it would be more like that was a clue. You know, we have file folders, so things get linked, whether it's a physical event happens and you link an emotional component to it and a spiritual component to it. I mean, it gets all linked together. And when one fires, they all fire. And so instead of trying to figure out where my thoughts were, we'd start looking at, okay, what just happened in the space? You know,
right.
Did they just dim the lights, or did a certain music just come on, or did a certain build of a person just go by, you know, and try to to narrow down triggers.
Right.
Because something simple, like, you know, the lights dimming, and maybe that would be enough to trigger me into disassociating.
Yeah.
And so being able to be aware of my triggers.
Right.
Was a step towards healing. And there are times, I mean, like even when I was proofreading a couple chapters of my book, it was like it kind of sent me right back, you know. But I think it has enabled me, one, to have compassion for other women. Or men. I mean, they're, you know, not just women that go through it, but to be able to offer support, because I've been there, and to say, you know, hey, there is life on the other side of this. I shared not too long ago, you know, that my mom had shared with me at the women's intensive that, you know, her mom would leave her at the movie theaters and while she was at work. So, I mean, I guess they paid like a nickel and could watch movies all day or whatever. And that, you know, men would, you know, make some kind of move that put her into fear, and she would go spend the entire time crouched in the bathroom floor in a stall until it was time for her mom to get off work. You know, so it's a generational thing somewhere.
Yeah.
And,
right.
You know, so that's why the name of my book is Healing Generations, and we do it one breath at a time. You know, and it actually started out with a still point session where I was a small Indian girl, and you know, if you ask me if I believe in past lives, I would say rational, you know, great, great, great grandmother or somebody that was this happened to. I haven't been able to track that down, that there's truth to that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whatever it is, whether it was me or not, it's up for me to heal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So to get to the point in your present life where you can trust, you get a toehold somewhere. Something really brought you back enough to have enough health.
And
to then
I have to give Michael credit for that because, I mean, even like there was one time, this was before we were married, and I think I must have been taking him to the airport or somewhere. I was driving, and he had a cup of tea, and I hit a bump. I remember it was an entrance ramp onto the interstate, and I hit a bump, mm-hmm. and his tea sloshed onto his pants. And, I mean, he even said something before I did. I mean, I looked at him, and he said there was such fear written in my face, like I thought he was going to, you know, hit me or something because – you know, I thought it was my fault that the tea sloshed onto his leg. And,
yeah.
You know, and that was like one of the first incidences then that he helped me to, you know, just breathe. It's okay. You know, no issue here. You know, you're fine. I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was,
mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the first ones of being able to say, okay, maybe I'm safe here.
Wow. And to have enough margin of somehow, sometime remembering that you had been safe at some point in your life so that you could gather yourself back, find your way back.
Right.
That's amazing.
Like one of the things that happened when I did finally leave that marriage, is that next year they didn't make you sign I'm probably the reason they make you sign a contract, but back then they didn't. I moved 10 times in 1 year, the geographic cure. I mean, it might just be another apartment across town. I mean, I don't think until towards the end did I ever move more than 15 miles away, but it was like going to a new house to start over, that I would be safe.
Is that partly literally so that he couldn't find you, or you just needed to get out?
Yeah, part of it was, you know, oh, he knows where I am. I need to go somewhere else. And as far as I know, like I said, he got married 3 months later, and as far as I know, he never even looked for me. But
wow.
It's just...
I'm glad you're doing a book for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
But this is amazing. How has it been going? You've been awfully busy.
Yeah, it has been crazy busy with Dad and everything. And, you know, like after the show, I'm going to go spend a couple hours with him. I hope to hear from the assisted living place and maybe get him settled. But back to the book, I've got probably 2/3 of it, maybe a little more than that, finished.
Mm-hmm. So it's at the stage where you feel as if you've got a hold of it. When I'm writing a piece of music, there'll be a point where I'm floating around and suddenly it will go down and I'll know, yay, I'm running now. This is a done deal. It's just a matter of following through now, but it's a thing. Whereas before, there's a while where you're hovering and I wasn't sure I had anything going, but it sounds very much as if this has established itself and it's just a matter of time and being able to concentrate on it.
Yeah, there for a while, it was, you know, especially when we were on the road, you know, and I got most of it done. We took a like a almost like a sabbatical one time, and we stayed in one place in Ellenton, Florida for several months. And I got a lot of that. That's when I actually first started writing it. And I got a lot done then because we weren't doing workshops or anything, and I didn't have any other commitments other than to Michael. And
you weren't doing the radio show yet?
Really? Yeah, we were.
Oh, okay.
But
that's a big deal.
Other than that, yeah. Yeah, it's an hour in the middle of the day. So,
I know.
But
it's a lot. Yeah.
But the last few days have been awesome healing for me.
Just recently, I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, just the last few days doing the radio show with you.
Wow.
I'm glad. Towards the end of this paper, I just scrolled down because we only have just a few more minutes. But at this one part, I say the present stage has been one of the most fulfillments so far. I grew into wisdom, and through that growth, I've learned many valuable lessons. I know in my future, just as I feel today, I will be able to reflect back on my life with great contentment, joy, and wonder, and I will see how I was ultimately able to overcome the crisis of each stage and turn it into victory. My chosen path and passion is to assist others to move back to their being, as well as continue my own growth. I believe Daniel Levinson is accurate in the summation of his theory when he says, the past and the future are in the present. There is always something for our continued growth in the present. We just need to look for the gift. I'm now in the process of this. When I wrote this, I was still in school. I'm in the process of earning my degree in psychology as the first step toward becoming a counselor so that I can take my work outside of the spiritual arena and reach more people. Richard Bach wrote in his book, The Bridge Across Forever, there are no mistakes. The events that we bring upon ourselves, no matter how unpleasant, are necessary in order to learn what we need to learn. Whatever steps we take, they're necessary to reach the places that we have chosen to go. Through all the challenges, the journey to my realization has been exactly what was needed, my gift, to bring me to where I am today. I am thankful for life, for my experiences, and for everyone whose path I have crossed, and for their continued love and support as I make my way back to being.
And so,
thank you for being part of that.
What are the tears about, Jeannie? Are they
just
what
gratitude?
Are they about? Are you sad or glad?
These are gratitude. I'm glad I survived and made it to here, and that there is a brighter future.
Wow.
And you wrote that at the end of writing your paper years ago?
Yeah, that was, well, see, I didn't go back to college until Ryan graduated. And so that was in 2010. That he graduated and got married, and then I went back to college. Mm-hmm. And we were on the road, and I was, I mean, I had to turn in three papers a week. And
wow.
I got my four-year degree in 3.5 years while we were on the road traveling and doing workshops. So a lot of times I would be sitting in the back of the room only giving Michael half an ear while I was writing papers for school.
Wow.
So, but, and graduated summa cum laude.
Good for you, Jeannie.
Yeah.
Well,
I loved learning. Yeah.
Well, so hearing all this, all these little strings of your life are some tying together. Remember that time you were working on the clutter in your house? And so now I can see where that came from. It's just fun to see the little ties going together. And then
there are probably many, many more of those, but thanks for letting us all in on that.
And one of the things, I think I told you that I found a company that will take stuff that might either go to Goodwill or to the trash or whatever. And so I was cleaning out the shed up behind the house, and so we'd have more storage space to get some things out of the house and mail, and maybe up into there. And I mean, like, I've cleared out so much stuff, and it was good to just be able to put it out in the yard and then have them come get it.
Yeah.
So I am still working on clutter, and right now it's still mom and dad's stuff. It's like,
wow,
never ending. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is something. When you move back into your childhood home, and there's probably a lot of, you know, I don't know what the word is, but memories leaking out of the walls. And
It's and it's things like there were, and I'm not exaggerating, I bet there were 2,000 pencils and pens in cans. And some of them might not, the pencils might be 2 inches long, and it's like, why did you keep that? Or a WD-40 can that's empty sitting on the shelf. But
that was that era. I mean, you're younger than I am, but there was the Depression, and there was a whole generation of people that didn't throw anything away.
Yeah, and
my
I think
mom
that was part
of
mom's, because she went through the Depression and where they had, what they call them, their stamps that they could use to get shoes, or stamps to get sugar, or ration stamps. And, you know, so she came up with that. I mean, you know, I've heard her say that the only time they ever got chewing gum was at Christmas. And but actually, Aria heard Michael singing the song the other day. What was it? Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? And she looked at him like he was crazy. And I said, well, and I told her, I said, used to people didn't get chewing gum all the time. I said, and my mom, I've heard her talk about, you know, that you did. You actually either stuck it on the bedpost, or while you were eating, you stuck it on the bottom edge of your plate or whatever so that you could put it back in your mouth afterwards. And she goes, oh, gross.
Boy.
But it was a different era.
It was, yeah.
Well, you've helped take me to the end again. I thank you so much.
Oh, Jeannie, this was so incredible to hear your book. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, and if, I remember you calling a while back, and Michael had gone somewhere else, and you said, I wonder if he's left. And there again, you know, of course he hadn't left, but you had turned him back into that. And I didn't know why you would be fearing that, but now I see.
Yeah.
So,
and there again, you know, like if you look at, okay, that's what I fear the most, and yet that's the first thing I want to do when I feel pressured.
Right.
Is to leave, you know, and we do. Just like that Bach said, we teach best what we most need to learn, what we accuse other people of doing. If we could just reflect the mirror, we could see that it's us.
Totally. Thank you,
Jeannie.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you. And we're down to the last few seconds, so I'll talk to you later, and I'll just tell everybody, thank you for being with us, and create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours.